Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another hour of Tribal Wisdom. I'm your host, Cynthia Williamson, and happy Wedding Wednesday to everybody. We always like to say happy Wedding Wednesday to our Facebook and our Twitter friends. We thank you so much for all the support that you always give us. We thank you so much for always listening in and sending us comments and suggestions for our shows. As you know, this month is Health Literacy Month, October is, and as well on Tribal Wisdom. And we've had some wonderful, wonderful guests on. We've had Juan Hagger of the Raw Mogulista. She came on to talk about changing your lifestyle and moving into a raw, healthy diet. We've had Reese Young come on about MyLivingHealthy.com. She talked about integrative nutrition, which is nutrition for mind, body, and spirit. We've had such a wonderful month of health talk and health literacy. I thought that we would continue with a very important topic, at least a topic that has touched my life this year. I've had a dear friend, a dear schoolmate, lost her husband to sudden unexpected death due to epilepsy. And her story was quite interesting when she was telling me all about it. One of the first things that she said was that she didn't even know. He'd never disclosed that he had had this condition. She didn't find out until she was well into the marriage with him. And then, of course, the bigger shock was that as she went into, you know, as the marriage continued, she found out that he refused to take his medication even when they began to start a family. And it was such a struggle for her to deal with. I'm not sure whether or not she really had a support system. So her story really touched me. And then I found out that there were similar stories like that within the community. So I'm so honored and pleased to have on the show tonight Miss Patricia Osborne Schaefer, who is an RN and an epilepsy nurse specialist, as well as doctor. Hold on, let me make sure I say this right. As well as Dr. Nathan B. Fountain, MD, professor of neurology. I'm more than honored to have them on tonight to talk about choices, management, treatments, and all sorts of other questions that can be answered during the show tonight. Lady and gentlemen, are you there with me right now, Doctor? And Patty, are you there?
Hi, this is Nathan Fountain. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for being on.
Hi, this is Patty Schaefer. Thank you.
Yay, you're both on. I love it. I'm so happy. Now, to the listeners, of course, you know that there are two ways that you can enjoy the show. You can enjoy the show via internet, or if you choose to call in with a question or a comment, the telephone number is 347-996-3160. We're going to get to know our guests tonight for the first half hour of the show, and somewhere around 10 o'clock or after 10 o'clock, if you have a question or a comment, call in, press the number 1 to let us know that you do want to speak with our guests, and we will take it from there. So let's just get right into it. Patty and Nathan, may I call you there? I should call you doctor. I'm sorry. It's just more respectful.
No, Nathan's just fine.
Nathan and Patty, I shared my story with you about my schoolmate, and you two came highly recommended to speak to about this particular subject. Why don't we start with your experiences with it? And Patty, you have the floor. What are your experiences with this particular condition and how you came to have such knowledge about it?
Okay, well, thank you very much, and it's nice to be here with you and Dr. Fountain today. I've come at epilepsy from a variety of different perspectives. I've worked in it for a number of years, over 30 years, as an epilepsy nurse specialist, mm-hmm. Which means that, you know, I work primarily with people who have seizures or epilepsy, either difficult to kind of diagnose, difficult to control, or having problems with living with it in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. So they need to have a better understanding of it, know how to better treat that, and just basically how to manage their life with epilepsy. And so I've seen many people similar to what you've talked about that occurred with a friend. I've also come at epilepsy from a different perspective. I lived with epilepsy all my life. So kind of actually the last thing I wanted to do was to work in epilepsy. But as I came to learn just in working in neurology, that I seem to have a pretty good understanding of some of the experiences that people might have and the feelings mm-hmm. associated with it. So mm-hmm. I decided to work in this area. And then I also had a child who had seizures when he was young. So from that perspective, I was very lucky that his seizures, he outgrew his seizures and didn't need to stay on medications in his adult life, where a number of people, like myself and many others, do need to stay on medicine.
Now, Dr. Nathan, can you give me an idea of some of the causes? Because when I was speaking with my friend, and she was telling me about this, and I said, wow, did you have your son checked? I mean, isn't this hereditary? And she said, no, his came from a traumatic event. You know, he'd fallen and hit his head, and there are multiple ways for you to have epilepsy. So I definitely wanted to share with our listeners, what are the different causes and ways that you get epilepsy or how epilepsy is caused?
Isn't that sort of the first obvious question? And often people who have a seizure, they come and say, why did I have it? Why do I have epilepsy? What is epilepsy? Sort of the first question they ask. And, of course, epilepsy just means you have seizures. So anything that causes seizures is epilepsy. And that's kind of a vague definition. And that means that almost anything that affects the brain, particularly the cortex, the gray matter, the neuron cells in the brain, particularly, but almost anything that affects the brain can cause seizures. Now, of course, some things are much more likely to cause seizures than others. Others, like head injury, is a very common cause, for instance, for your friend. And that often happens, you know, the people most likely to have a head injury are young men, because young men do dumb things often. They predispose themselves to head injury. And consequently, that's a common thing. Now, usually it's a mild head injury, but if it's a serious head injury, one that may knock somebody out or a penetrating head injury, something that goes into the head and into the brain, then they could have seizures because it sets up a place in the brain where there's an electrical storm, and seizures are really just an electrical storm of the brain. So if you have one spot in the brain that's not acting right, where it kind of isn't wired right anymore because of the injury of whatever caused it, then it can set up a focus for seizures. And you're right, it makes sense to think most about something like a head injury, but it's also true, it can be genetic. It usually isn't, but it can be. So when we think about the causes, there's this whole huge spectrum. And the good news is that among those people who inherit it, who have the inherited kinds of epilepsy that pass it on to their children or get it from their parents, those are usually really easy to control. Not true for everybody, of course, but that's commonly true. And so the more severe people tend to be the kind that are acquired. So almost anything can cause it.
Now, Patty mentioned that you had a child who had seizures when they were young, and then they no longer have seizures. Is that the case?
Yes, for a number of people that can happen. I think if you think about if we think about a group of people who all start developing epilepsy this year, 2013, about 60% of those with new onset seizures could become easily controlled with medications, and and some of whom may come off of medications. So it's really only about 30 to 40% of them who have either difficult to control seizures or don't respond well or have problems with side effects of medication. So in my son's case, you know, they were difficult to control for 3 to 4 years, kind of, but once he found that medicine that worked, he remained seizure-free on that, and after a number of years was able to come off medication successfully. So we often don't think about that whole group of people when we think about seizures and epilepsy, but it happens in large numbers of people. So that's the real good news of it. The difficult part is those 30 to 40% who can't really come off medications, and who are, and that's, you know, over a million people, you know, that will have that. And actually, if you think of the big scope of it, you think about how many people have epilepsy, you know, in a year, it's about 2.2 to 3 million people who have epilepsy at any point in time, and at least over a million of those have uncontrolled seizures.
Wow. Now, it's really interesting.
Can
to
I
me
just add one more thing here? We,
sure.
When Dr. Nathan here defined epilepsy and seizures, mm-hmm. I think it's important to tell the audience that a lot of times people don't know they have epilepsy because people don't use that term, that mm-hmm. they'll often say, well, you just have seizures or you have a seizure disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And seizure disorder is really the same thing as epilepsy. All it means is that you have a tendency to recurring seizures or you've had at least two seizures in your life. It doesn't mean anything more. It doesn't mean that anything else bad is happening or associated. It just means that you have a tendency to seizures. So if we think about the numbers of people with epilepsy, that's what I'm citing is probably a conservative estimate because a lot of people might have seizures that don't really know it because it's
mm-hmm.
called by a different name.
Okay. Well, to either one of you can answer the next question because with what you just said about being able to come off medication, my question is, seizures can be caused by some sort of brain injury or event. Do the seizures stop because the brain has healed itself?
Now, sometimes it does. So we don't really know what causes seizures. We just know that they come from someplace that isn't right. And so you can think of the brain as wired just like a computer or your television or radio.
Mm-hmm.
And usually things operate normally in that circuit, just like your television or radio. But if you take the two ends and short them out together, you can create a loop. If you create a loop, then it just is self-reinforcing. That self-reinforcing loop then kind of breaks out of that area and synchronizes the whole brain. So in other words, it makes an electrical storm in which everything's acting together, which normally would be acting in its own separate part and behaving properly. So why it decides to break out at this minute and not that minute, that's a real mystery. And of course, if you have seizures, if you want to know, am I going to have one today or tomorrow or in 5 minutes?
Right.
And unfortunately, we can't really tell people, although about half of people with epilepsy say, you know, I'm more likely to have a seizure when I'm stressed, which is probably not surprising, or sleep-deprived. And for some people, it's with an infection, for instance.
It seems like stress is the cause of a lot of difficulties in the body, whether it be a seizure, whether, you know, I mean, just all kinds of things I've heard happen with stress and the body. So I agree that's quite likely that people know that when they're under a lot of stress, they know that they're going to have or they feel that they might have a seizure that day. So with that being said, would you say, and either one of you can answer this question, would you say that stress management, because we're also going to, you know, I would like to get into management of this condition. Stress management is a big deal when it comes to epilepsy?
Well, I certainly think it is, but I want to back up a minute and define a little bit about what might trigger a seizure as well as what's a cause. So
okay.
I think it's really important to know that seizures are caused by a physical, you know, problem in the brain or that can cause like this electrical storm. And
mm-hmm.
every single one of us has a tendency to have seizures, but some of us have a greater tendency to others. And that's when other factors can come in and trigger it or make it more likely to happen. So let's say I have seizures, and so there might be certain things that might trigger it or be more likely to happen. Now, I take medications to control that, and ideally the medications will work. But despite the best medicine in the world, you know, if someone's taking seizure medicines, that it also could be at risk for these seizure breakthroughs or something that might trigger it and make it more likely.
Mm-hmm.
Stress can be one of those factors. And when you know that stress might be a trigger for you, then absolutely learning how to manage that stress, figuring out what are the things that do kind of set your stress level over the edge. You know, what can you do to help better manage that's a real important factor. Some people think it might be, you know, big stressors that affect them, but for many people, it's kind of the buildup and the culmination of daily hassles and stresses. So really learning how to manage that kind of stuff is critical. It's not going to get rid of the seizures, but it's critical to help with the way the medications and other things are used to treat it.
I think it's important. That's also something that individuals actually have control over, as Patty said. So while you might not have control over which medicines you need to take or how much or what time, you do have control over learning to control your stress. We've tried to do a really interesting study in this regard, a kind of meditation called Qigong, which is a type of Tai Chi meditation.
Yes.
To help people with epilepsy.
Yes, I've seen them doing that in the park a lot, and I did read up on that.
Exactly. So it's kind of almost a martial art, but of course doesn't involve any fighting. It's just meditation and moving your body through space. But to illustrate just how problematic seizures can be for people, we've been really unable to find a sufficient number of people who qualify for the study, meaning they have seizures often enough, live close enough to where we are, which is Charlottesville, because if you have seizures, then you can't drive, for at least in Virginia, for 6 months after your last seizure. And in most states, that's the case. Some states it's 3 months, some's a year. But usually it's about 6 months. And that means if you have active seizures, you can't drive. And now transportation is a big problem, particularly if you live in a rural area like Virginia. So I think, that, unfortunately, that adds to your stress in a way that we can't help with if you can't get here. But it kind of illustrates how sometimes seizures are really problematic. But on the other hand, how if you are able to access things, you can help to control at least a little bit by controlling your stress.
You know, having said that, is really a great opener to something else that I would really like to talk about, which is stigma around epilepsy. Like, it was such a shock to me to find out that this young man refused to take his medication. I mean, he was in complete denial to the point where he kept saying, I'm fine, I don't need it, I don't have seizures, all of these different things, but he was clearly having them in his sleep. His son saw them every now and again, but he was just so adamant about it just wasn't happening to him. What are some of the reasons, and the fact that you said that transportation can become an issue that can trigger a little stress, what are some of the other issues or stigmas that come along with epilepsy that people can actually manage if they really kind of, you know, come out of denial and say, this is who I am, this is what I have, let me figure out how I can live with this?
Yeah. Well, you've raised such a huge part of it. And I think when we use the term stigma, we've got to think about stigma in two different ways. Mm-hmm. It's what the person with the seizures feels. So it's that kind of, you know, perceived stigma. Mm-hmm. And then the other stigma is what you might feel coming from the outside or from other people, yeah, mm-hmm. and or from what we feel from society because they first have a disability or they have epilepsy, and there might actually be laws, driving laws, that they feel that they aren't allowed to do things. People might not be hired, feel like they're discriminated against because they've got a disability, in this case an epilepsy. So mm-hmm. there's different aspects of stigma that play into that. And then there's also kind of the whole stigma, both things that are affected by what society thinks about people with epilepsy. So in this case, I mean, when people first hear that they have epilepsy, you think the worst. Something's wrong with me. You know, mm-hmm. is there something different about me? Or does this mean I have a mental illness or I'm not smart or I'm not pretty or whatever? But there's kind of a bad connotation a lot of times to the word. So then people get scared, and probably fear is one of the biggest problems with kind of accepting and adjusting to the epilepsy. It's that fear of what's going on, what is happening, what could happen, feeling kind of a loss of control. You can't necessarily control your body or your mind during the event. So that can be a pretty scary thing. And when you're feeling that kind of, you know, fear and anxiety, what do we normally do? We get angry.
Right.
So, you know, if you don't see yourself having a seizure, particularly if your seizures are happening at night, you know, people are telling you something's going on, you can't see it, you can't tell what's going on, you get angry. And in many, many people, if you can't see the seizures, what do you get mad at? You get mad at what you can see. You get mad at your doctor, your nurse, you get mad at the pills that they're telling you to take. So oftentimes the mixture of feelings that people can have about having the epilepsy or the fear of what might happen to their life gets taken out on themselves and then taken out on their medication. So we end up doing what's probably the worst things for us. We make our epilepsy worse because we're getting mad at it, and you take it out on the medications, refuse to take it, and then you have more problems with seizures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a really pretty complex thing. No easy, you know, magic bullet in terms of, say, how do I deal with it? It means trying to kind of understand it, come to terms with all the, you know, the fears, the anxieties, the worries that it's causing, and then think about, now what do I do to make it better? you know, I'm not going to get it better by just kind of not accepting it. So what can I do to kind of feel okay about this and to try to get these seizures under better control?
Okay,
I think
so
maybe it's important to recognize that's kind of like life, isn't it? You know,
mm-hmm, it really is.
We all encounter different, if you think of it that way, you know, we all encounter different things. And probably, the most stressful thing you can have in life, of course, is have a child die or a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of stress, I guess getting married is going to be one of the biggest stresses there.
Yes,
I'm sure. Germane to our discussion. But that means there are lots of stresses in life. Some are transient, like the wedding. Others are more permanent, like being married, I suppose. So I think if you kind of think of it like that, it's really important to help people understand that this is really just another part of life, and it doesn't have to change everything they do and their lifestyle. They just have to exercise themselves a little differently than they might otherwise, but not in a way that's going to deteriorate their life.
Well, then, I have a twofold question about that, because are there support systems, groups, therapists or the like that help people kind of transition into understanding the condition, that they have this condition and how to live with it? And since I know that, Dr. Nathan, you're a professor of neurology, is there a course that up-and-coming doctors take in order to help patients through, you know, when they get diagnosed?
There are pathways of training. All the most common pathways for a neurologist, so someone who's a medical doctor that specializes in neurology, to then subspecialize in epilepsy, which is kind of a new idea. And as a whole group, we now have epilepsy centers, which are centers designed to take care of people with epilepsy. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of working our way up the specialist tree, you might say, so that a lot of people, when they first have a seizure, might go see their family doctor in other countries or other situations.
Mm-hmm.
That's often who would manage it in England, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But in the United States, I think almost everybody who has a seizure or at least has epilepsy is going to end up seeing a neurologist. And a
mm-hmm.
lot of neurologists are well qualified to take care of people with epilepsy. But if their seizures don't come under control after trying just one or two medications, then they would see an epilepsy specialist. And that often would be at an epilepsy center, but there are epilepsy specialists who aren't necessarily at epilepsy centers. And the special training that you could have formally is that neurology residency takes 4 years, which is what all neurologists do, and then epilepsy specialty training is 1 or 2 years after that. But that's not a large group of people. In the United States, there are about 180 epilepsy centers.
Mm-hmm.
If you do the math, there are 300 million people, a little over that, in the United States.
Wow.
And Patty said about 2 million of them have epilepsy, maybe more, actually more than 2 million. And then if you say that, well, about half of those people are doing really great, so
mm-hmm.
they can see the general neurologist or whoever, that still leaves 500,000 people. And if you divide the number of people with epilepsy by the number of epilepsy specialists, you come up with about almost 2,000. So theoretically, each epilepsy specialist should have about 2,000 patients, which might actually
wow.
be true. Well, probably isn't a good idea. We probably need more epilepsy specialists.
Probably.
But that aside, that means that people who have seizures and epilepsy who aren't controlled either to their satisfaction or typically, in my view, if they're having any seizures at all, they need to see an epilepsy specialist, not someone who has particular training in it.
Wow.
So let me add there, too, that, well, I think it's critical that everybody, you know, does see an epilepsy specialist when you're still having seizures or things aren't going well. You know, it's important not to focus on just the seizures. Things cannot be going well in life. For example, you're having trouble coping with it. You're having these challenges, and it's affecting your life, and you're saying, what do? I'm having trouble working. I can't drive. It's affecting my relationship. I'm feeling down or depressed, you know, or I'm having problems in school. Any of these kinds of things can happen because of the way epilepsy is affecting you, how it's affecting your brain or how you're feeling or in many ways. So in that case, you've got to think about, yes, I need to talk about this stuff with my doctor, but who else can I see? So obviously I'm a nurse, so I'll say, if you got a nurse, talk to a nurse.
Yes, please, please give yourself a plug, please.
Really, give the nursing profession a plug. But absolutely, I see a counselor, you know, see a social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, Feeling down and depressed isn't an excuse to stay that way. If you're feeling bad, you absolutely should see one. Good news, too, is that there's lots of help out in the community and in support groups. The Epilepsy Foundation of America has affiliates throughout the country. So in most states or regions, you can find a group where they may have, you know, in-person support groups. There's more online communities now. You can find through the Epilepsy Foundation at www.epilepsy.com. Many of the other epilepsy organizations also have different chats and support groups for parents, siblings, grandparents, camps. So there's a whole host of ways. It's things that people don't often hear about but are there. So I'd really, you know, suggest that anybody who's, you know, has epilepsy or they have a child or a spouse or anyone or a friend, you know, with epilepsy, that they find someone to talk about it with. So they're not feeling all alone, that they're finding some help that they need, that they, you know, they find a support group so they can say, what do I do next? Where can I find that help?
Excellent. Now, if you're just tuning in, we are talking. The topic tonight for Health Literacy Month is epilepsy, and we are speaking with Patricia Schaefer and Dr. Nathan Fountain, of a professor of neurology, and of course Patricia Schaefer is a nurse. And in a few minutes, we'll be taking questions and comments if you choose to, only if you want to. Otherwise, we're happy to have you listening in. So if you're listening in, 347-996-3160. If you would like to have a question or a comment, press the number 1 to let us know that you are in queue. Now, I would like to know more about the Epilepsy Foundation. I like that you talked about there's an online community, because I'm not sure that people are always aware of the different ways that they could connect with people that can help them or a support system. So if you could just tell us more about all the places. I know we can find the Epilepsy Foundation on Facebook. I found them there. I thought it was an excellent, beautiful page. Where are the other places that people can connect to get more information or support?
Well, the Epilepsy Foundation has merged with another organization called Epilepsy Therapy Project. So right now that there's two places. Our websites are merging. There's epilepsyfoundation.org and then epilepsy.com. And as of the end of this year, epilepsy.com will be the major site. And they have these e-communities where people can be, you know, commenting on articles, you know, posting in community forums, writing blogs, or chatting online. So that can certainly be found in any either of those sites now, and by the end of the year going just to epilepsy.com. There's other places as well, though. So, for example, there's many different types of epilepsy, and so there might be some – there's a type of epilepsy called Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So there's an organization with the LGS Foundation where you can go and you can talk with parents and families that have a family member just with Lennox-Gastaut. The same thing can be said for people who might have tuberous sclerosis, another form or cause of epilepsy. So I think you can find just all those names of organizations through the Epilepsy Foundation or also through the American Epilepsy Society, where you can find the kind of, you know, communities that you might relate to the best. So that's kind of one place to have it. Now, that's if you're thinking about online, but I guess I would encourage people, too, to really search out the in-person kind of contact. It's way too easy to get so isolated and not be able to really see and talk with people who have epilepsy. So there you might find the Epilepsy Foundation affiliates right in your own community. And if you went to epilepsyfoundation.org or epilepsy.com and clicked on Find an Affiliate, you can put in your zip code and come right up with the affiliate closest to you. And please also check out their Facebooks and Twitter and all those other places that we're all at now these days.
Wonderful.
Those are great sites. And you know what I find easy and easy to tell people, easy to remember myself, is epilepsy.com. That doesn't get any simpler than that to remember. There are lots of places to go, but that's a really great place to start.
Nice. Now, again, I have every time you guys say something, give me like a new question. I'm like, oh, great, because I'm glad that you opened up the floor to types of epilepsy. Something that Dr. Nathan said, in fact, I'll start with that one and then we can get back to types of epilepsy. Is there a program or something available for individuals who are interested in individuals who are in the medical field who are interested in specializing in that field? Are there any type of programs or something available like that, Dr. Nathan?
Well, there are lots of different ways that people can interact and be involved. It all starts with an interest. So, of course, for physicians we talked about, but also Patty can talk about nurses, and nurses who have an interest in epilepsy can seek it out by being either neurology nurses in the community or epilepsy specialist nurses in centers or in larger hospitals, but really across the whole spectrum. For you can imagine that people with epilepsy have a lot of very, very diverse problems that are kind of unique. For instance, if you think about not being able to drive but otherwise being perfectly healthy, that's a really unique problem.
Yes,
so
it is.
So social workers are particularly important to them. So social workers that understand that can be helpful. Psychologists, psychiatrists, really people across the whole medical spectrum who have a particular interest can specialize in epilepsy. And that's, if you're not getting what you need, if you have epilepsy or your family member knows someone and they're not getting what they need, I'd really encourage them to seek out someone who has special knowledge, because it's pretty easy when someone with epilepsy who walks into the clinic or to go see someone, say a social worker, and they're perfectly healthy and young person and otherwise is very functional, and they say they have this very specific need, for instance, that their work's not accommodating them, for instance. And if someone shrugs it off and says, well, you're otherwise healthy and fine, I have other things to do, then that's a real problem. So if they're
doing
what they really need to go seek out someone who has a special interest. But there isn't a particular course, which is really your question, I realize. Is there a course? And there isn't. For professionals, the American Epilepsy Society can help them get what they need. But for others outside of, really that applies mostly to nurses and to physicians and psychologists. But for other health professionals, there isn't really a very good spot they can get it all together. But the Epilepsy Foundation can help almost anybody in any capacity to provide special expertise or interest to people with epilepsy. You can imagine lawyers are an important part of this. So if you're discriminated against because you have epilepsy, which is actually covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, then you want to be able to find a lawyer who understands that and can advocate for you.
Well, you know, go on.
I just wanted to add that the Epilepsy Foundation does have some very specific programs to certain audiences. So, for example, there is a course for school nurses, because it's so critical that school nurses know what to do when children have seizures and how it affects, you know, a child's development and their whole life. So if you're a parent out there and you have a child with seizures or you know anyone with, go to your school nurse and ask them to contact the Epilepsy Foundation and make sure that, you know, they bring a school nurse training there. And there's also trainings for law enforcement and first responders and things like that. So anyone who is, you know, interested in this in any way or feels that they're in a field where it needs training or would like to find out what's available, I'd have them call the Epilepsy Foundation or the American Epilepsy Society.
Wonderful. Let's talk about discrimination for a while, because I know that neither one of you are a lawyer, but the types of discriminations that people experience, and just in case they may not know they're experiencing it, what are the type of things that people come up against, and who they go to? Can they go to the Epilepsy Foundation in order to get help with it?
Well, I'd say there's a number of things that are common sort of across the board. They kind of fall in the sphere of school, work, and kind of public life. And maybe Patty could comment on school. I'd say as far as your work life goes, the places where people might feel discriminated against is if they're either not given a job to begin with, and I have to say that hiring for anything is so complicated, that's unlikely to be fruitful. So in other words, if you think you haven't been hired just because you have epilepsy, that's a pretty difficult case to prove, and I actually don't think that's so much of a problem. I think a greater, or at least more common problem is someone who has epilepsy is on the job, then they have a seizure, and it makes everyone nervous, and so then the job someone may not allow them to return to work until they've done something special or not let them do their regular job, even when having a seizure doesn't have anything to do with their job. Let's imagine they have a desk job, and if they have a seizure, it's not a problem. Particularly, we haven't really talked about the different kinds of seizures, but the most common kind of seizure is just staring. It's not falling down and falling all over. So if you have that kind of seizure, it doesn't really necessarily disrupt your work. And if it does, it's just like being sick in any other way that day. Simply go home and come back to work the next day, for example. So if someone feels discriminated against on that basis, then the first recourse is to talk to the employer and explain to them your condition. The second recourse, usually talk to the human resources department, the employment department. Then after that, I'd say the Epilepsy Foundation, your local affiliate. So, for example, here in Virginia, that would be the Epilepsy Foundation of Virginia. Most states have an affiliate. And they can help work through the system. They can go to the employer and say, look, people with epilepsy are covered with the Americans with Disabilities Act, and so you're required to give them a reasonable accommodation. And besides that, there's no reason not to. So you can just explain the situation to them. Works. And then if that doesn't work, then it's time to find a lawyer.
Right. Right. You know, because I'm just thinking about my friend and her situation, I don't think that he experienced any type of discrimination until I think he did have a seizure on the job, and he had one of those top level jobs on Wall Street, so it did affect him once they found out about it. But at the same time, it could have been controlled with medication. So it's a whole kind of oxymoron that I just can't understand, other than what Patricia was saying earlier about how people are just angry at the disease, they're angry at the medication, they're just plain angry, and they don't necessarily seek the help that they need in order to get past it to live a full life, in order to live a full life.
So, you know, let me jump in there. I think that's, you know, it is so hard to understand because, you know, I mean, this is one reason why you had that show, because when this happened, it was like so much about epilepsy you didn't really realize before. So if you magnify that and think about how many people in our society don't really know what epilepsy is, well, that just shows you all the problems that people with seizures are going to run into, that people don't understand what's going on with them. And if you see someone having a seizure, you think, well, that's not right. Something must be wrong. You know, I don't want them to work for me, or I don't want that child to come to my school, or I don't think that, you know, they can do those things. And so people are faced all the time by people trying to prevent them in some way, shape, or form from participating in life in whichever way they are. So there's the issues of yourself thinking about, you know, the epilepsy is keeping you from doing things, or it's the issues of other people thinking that you can't do it. And just because you have seizures doesn't mean that you can't function and do these things. But you do have a lot of different barriers in life. And that's a big part, is that kind of whole public awareness, helping people understand what are the real barriers and how do you get people help for that. And yet, what are the barriers that society's putting up, and which barriers do we have to take down? You know, why can't a child go to school and participate in all the school-based activities that all their friends do? You know, why can't a person hold a job down on Wall Street and still, you know, even if they have seizures, but still go to work and do their job? But for many people, you know, they're prevented from doing that.
Yeah, I'd have to say, as kind of to be maybe a little bit cavalier about it, I can't emphasize enough, as you probably know, that men are just boneheads, right? We're resistant to understanding. We think we're immortal, particularly young men. Now I'm an old man, but when I was a young man, I probably thought I was immortal too. But, you know, men, we think we're immortal. We, in classically, the kind of thing like don't listen to directions because don't want to be given directions, so forth. So I think that most men probably, of course, are much more realistic and grounded and rational than that. But I do think there's an undercurrent for men in particular. So I can imagine, so if you imagine someone who's a high-powered Wall Street executive and now has something happen that's entirely outside of their control, and they're used to being entirely in control, then they'd really like to just dismiss it, to not deal with it, and to hope it goes away. Or I don't suppose most people really think if you ignore it, it'll go away, but they're sort of hoping that that will minimize it so it won't be a problem. And so I think that's a really common problem, probably more often for young men than older men, but I think it has to be recognized so that up front you can reassure people, you know, you're not crazy, you don't have some unrelated psychiatric problem. It's just a medical condition that happens to give you seizures, and to reassure them that the vast majority of the time it just turns out fine.
Well, two more topics that I definitely want to touch on. I want to get back into the types of seizures that people can have, because I do know that he passed away of sudden unexpected death due to epilepsy or due to a seizure. And then I want to talk about the consequences. I want to understand. I want people to understand the significance of taking their medication after hearing my friend's story. So I do want to scare people a little bit tonight about the importance of really just going ahead and taking your medication and living your life and really trying to enjoy your life and enjoy your family. That yes, there are some barriers, but it shouldn't stop you from completely enjoying life or doing things that you want to do. So if we can touch on the different types of seizures, and then let's get into medications and consequences for not, what does a seizure actually do, first of all, to the brain? Because I heard words like atrophy and all of these other things. What does a seizure do to the brain?
The good news is that usually it doesn't do anything to the brain. So it's for the vast majority of time. Let's imagine that even if you have a seizure, it kills off a few or dozens of neurons of brain cells. We start with so many billion to begin with that having a single seizure usually doesn't have any perceptible effect. So it's such a dramatic thing to see someone having a convulsive seizure, a big shaking seizure. You think to yourself, this must injure the brain. This is a dramatic, huge event that's life-changing.
Well, I mean, to see
probably
something
more
like it would injure your mind. I feel injured when I have to see it, so it would scare me, almost near to
death.
Exactly.
It's such a dramatic thing. You think, first, you think they're going to die. This is life-threatening. Mm-hmm. And second, you think, oh, my goodness, this is going to injure the brain. And so the good news is that, of course, these things can't happen, and that's why it's a serious topic, part of why we're talking about it tonight. But the vast majority of time, people survive a seizure fine, and their brain doesn't have any perceptible brain injury. Mm-hmm. And that's because of which parts of the brain tend to be involved. So some parts are more susceptible than others, and you can imagine that even if it doesn't matter if you have a seizure and injure a few neurons today or tomorrow, of course, over the course of your lifetime, if you have very many seizures, then it can lead to some degree of brain problem. But I would say the vast majority of time, the underlying condition really gives much more problem than the seizures as this goes. In other words, if you've already had a brain injury, let's say from traumatic head injury from a motor vehicle accident, from a car crash, that might have given you more problems than the seizure would to injure your brain.
So Dr. Nathan, I like saying that. Dr. Nathan raised an important point. While you think about what does a single seizure do versus what happens when you have seizures over time. And I think that kind of gets to the crux, Cynthia, of what you were, talking about with the consequences.
Yes.
So it might not be that bad if your seizures can be easily controlled, except you're dealing with the effect around your life and, the school or the work and stuff. But if you're having seizures that won't go away and you're dealing with side effects of medicine, what can happen? People's thinking can be affected in many ways. So the more common thing people report is that they're having trouble paying attention or remembering things. Kind of short-term memory becomes a problem. Sometimes if you're having trouble with attention, you can also have trouble learning new things or remembering them over time. Different kinds of cognitive problems or the thinking skills, depends upon where the seizures might be coming from. But that can certainly become a factor for people. So if you have trouble thinking, remembering, that can affect schooling. That can affect work. You also see that, I think in general society, having a mood disorder, depression, anxiety or something, it's not necessarily uncommon, but if you take a group of people with epilepsy, just kind of a community sample of it, you'll have, mood disorder occurring in up to 25-30% of the people. Yet if you take a group of just people with uncontrolled seizures, those mood disorders can occur in up to 50%. Mm-hmm. And when I'm talking about a mood disorder, I'm not just saying, oh, I'm feeling sad or I'm having a mood swing. This is a depression, anxiety, something that is significant that needs treatment. So that's a certain major consequence. That increases the risk that suicidal thoughts and actual completed suicide is higher in people with epilepsy and in people with uncontrolled epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you can, you know, you have the risk of falls and injuries and other things with certain kinds of seizures, you know, so you think about those accidents, and most of our people will brush that off, but people can die from accidents too. People can die from having a seizure in a bathtub or in a lake. So, you know, I am all with you with stressing that, you know, you want to stress that people can live their life, but there are serious consequences, ranging from the bumps and bruises to the dying from accidents to the mood disorders, the cognitive problems, or as you opened this up with, the fact that people can die suddenly without any, you know, warning ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. See, one of the
You ask us a question, we always give you two answers, and I'm afraid that's kind of the way it is. Either end of this.
I like it, but
so
I like it.
We're trying to reassure people that usually it's going to be fine, and that by getting the right kind of assistance, everything almost always turns out fine. But on the other hand, it doesn't always, and so we have to do what we can to prevent those kind of problems. And I think it'll be really important that we talk about that at the end, because people feel tremendous guilt every time something bad happens, and we have to reassure people that it's never their fault, either the individuals or anyone around them.
Now, my concern is, like, one of the things that my schoolmate was talking to me about was the fact that when she would talk to her husband and say, listen, you really have to take your medication. It's really important that you control this, that we get this under control, and because he wouldn't, she wouldn't allow him to take the baby out like on trips and things, and that angered him further, because she said, listen, you know, first you don't drive, which is great, but you take the baby on the train. What if you had a seizure on the train and you know, what's going to happen with the baby? Or what if you're on the platform and you fall into the tracks? You know, she had so many concerns that she would talk to him about, but it still kind of wasn't getting through. So that's, you know, that's one of the main reasons why I'm saying we need to get a little scare into people, not just for their sake, but for the sake of their family. It's one thing to not do what you're supposed to do for yourself, but when you bring other individuals into it, it's so selfish. There's a level of selfish that is very scary. You know, so that's the main reason why I want to talk about consequences and some of the things that can happen, especially in public, if you have, you know, someone with you. If you're holding, you know, he wanted to hold his newborn son, and everyone was always kind of like surrounding him and around him, and he didn't like it. He was like, I can do this. And they're like, okay, you're just being stubborn. You know what I mean? You're scaring the rest of us.
Yeah, now you see exactly why we're always saying two opposite things. We're saying, yes, lead a normal life, do everything you normally do, but you're going to have to be a little bit careful about these things.
Right.
I will say that means the spectrum of problems and issues come across the board as well. So you're exactly right. We'd prefer to kind of scare people straight.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we don't want to scare anybody who's already doing the things they need to do. So that's why we're always of two minds.
So this also gets into the fact that, you know, epilepsy is not a one-size-fits-all disorder. So it looks and feels and is different for many people. So if we think, you know, and I'm a big proponent of people assessing their risks or assessing their risks with their doctor. You know, what is my risk for consequences? What could happen to me? Do I have the kind of seizures that I could be at jeopardy for certain problems? What's my risk for dying, or what's not my risk for dying?
Mm-hmm.
So you can better understand and say, how important is treatment for me, and what are the kinds of safety precautions I have to take for myself but also for other people? So if you think about the kinds of seizures, you know, some seizures might be very mild. You can have, if you think, I'm going to break it down real quickly into groups of seizures. You might have partial seizures or seizures that start in one area of the brain, and many of those, it might be just a change in a movement, a sensation, feelings, and you don't lose consciousness. You're not confused, so you stay really aware, but there's some kind of change in behavior that's happening. That's actually a seizure.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that kind of a case, if that's all you have and you're never losing awareness or consciousness with it, your risks for a number of the things that we're talking about, maybe where you lose consciousness and fall and injure yourself, or your risk for SUDEP is very low. You could also have those partial seizures that can progress to or spread to involve areas of the brain that involve your awareness or consciousness. So now during the seizure, you might kind of stare off into space and wander and actually, you know, walk or fall. Well, yes, those people can be at risk, for example, at a train station, that they wander off the side of a train platform. I've had that happen to people before. Or if you're out with your children and you're suddenly not there and confused and unable to kind of, you know, take care of yourself, let alone your children, what do you do? So when you have these different kinds of seizures, you've got to think about what are the ramifications for myself or for others. Now, another group of seizures are generalized seizures, where it affects kind of the whole brain at once, and that could range from kind of a minor one for a brief couple seconds of a brief lapse of awareness and staring, and by itself, a second or two of not being aware of things may not bother you at all. But if you had bunches of those at a time, you can be in confusional states and kind of be confused, not really know what's going on, and that can get to be a very dangerous situation. Or you could run the gamut at the other end where you have a complete loss of consciousness, and that's what is known as a term of tonic-clonic, grand mal, or convulsion. Mm-hmm. Where your body gets stiff, you may fall to the ground, there might be some jerking movements of it. And that's the kind that probably looks the scariest, but it's also the one that can be the most dangerous. You can obviously injure yourself during the seizure itself, but if the seizure lasted too long, then you get into a life-threatening situation. Most seizures only last a minute or two, but if you had one of these convulsive seizures that lasted, you know, 5 minutes or longer, you're into a life-threatening situation. And then people can die from repeated seizures.
Yes. Yes, because we believe this is what happened with my friend's husband, because he, in fact, I think that's what the doctor did, was warning him. He was like, you know, you're getting really close to really, you know, dying because of these continued seizures that you're having. And you think that you're not having them, but you're having them almost nightly at this point because you refuse to take your medication. So I'm so glad that you said that it is something that you could possibly die from. Now, the next two questions are, what questions would a person ask a doctor after they've had a seizure? What kind of information should they be collecting? That's the first question. And second, for a situation like my friend had, where he never disclosed that he had this condition and she found out well into the marriage, what kind of information should she or someone like her in her situation be seeking? Because she wasn't even allowed to be in the room after he had the seizure, and the husband left it up to the doctor to come out and tell her because he was uncomfortable even admitting it in front of his wife. So it's a very scary situation. I think when it comes to getting married and not disclosing a serious medical condition like that.
That probably happens more often than we think. I'm sure it happens more often than I think, because I only see people when they are disclosing it, at least to me, and then constantly to their family members. But I think there's sort of three different kinds of ways to think about that. From a medical perspective, if someone's having spells of some type that might be a seizure, then it's really important or helpful to the care provider, to the physician, in order to figure out if that's a seizure or not, to have someone who's actually seen one, because it's the nature of a seizure that for most kinds, while you're having the seizure, your brain is busy having the seizure and doesn't know what's going on, and afterwards usually doesn't remember it. It kind of erases your tape, if you will. It's really important for someone who's seen the seizures or spells to come with them to the doctor to describe them, to kind of characterize them, make sure everyone understands, particularly the doctor, what's going on. Mm-hmm. So as a starting point, that's really important. For people who have established seizures, that's kind of a different group. It's still important to have someone who can describe them in detail, but also to keep track of how frequently they occur. And in a way, that's kind of obvious. What else are you going to do? Of course, you're going to keep track of how they occur, how often they occur. But what people tend to do, everyone's busy, life is busy, they tend to guess and estimate. And if you're having them every day, then you can probably do that pretty well. But anything less than that, you probably aren't going to estimate very well. And unfortunately, it's the nature of treatment that usually it's little steps at a time. So increase the medicine, see if they get better. If they do, increase it some more and see if they get better, and increase it some more and see if they get better. And consequently, it's really important to know how frequently they're occurring so you can keep track of it and see if you're going in the right direction, if they're actually getting less frequent. Because if they're not, you might need to do something different. Or if they're becoming more frequent, you need to know about that. So the second piece of information then would be, how frequent are they?
I'd like to add a few things there in terms of, you know, questions people should ask as well as the importance of disclosure. So I like to think about epilepsy as a family affair. So Dr. Nathan just, you know, stressed how important it is that someone else that may have seen seizures, you know, really is kind of part of the whole treatment plan because, you know, they have valuable information that the person who's having the seizures might not be. But they're also just part of the experience. You know, they're not actually having the seizures, but they're experiencing them day in and day out.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll experience them very different. It's very hard for family members because you have this sense of helplessness. If you've got a family member that's got a, you know, injured leg, well, you know you can physically see it, and then you figure out how you can help them. But when you have the seizures and those that occur unpredictably, you feel helpless because you don't know, well, what can I do and when can I do it and how do I help them? So very important that people talk about it with, you know, the doctors and say, you know, how is this going to affect me? How might it affect my family? You know, what do I need to know in terms of the kind of seizures that I have? What are the risks or what don't I have to worry about? You know, make sure you ask, can I drive? And if I can't, what do I do? How can I get around? Instead of just giving up, what can you say? What are my options? You need to ask why you need treatment. A lot of times people, you know, have trouble following through the medications because they don't understand why they really need it on a daily basis. It's not the pill you can take just one day and not the next. It's pills that you need to take and build up in your system and keep taking them every day. So you need to understand why you need it, and then you need to say, how can I do it? You know, just writing a prescription and taking one, you know, four times a day or, you know, two twice a day, that doesn't cut it. You know, you need to kind of really understand how can you make it work for you, part of your life, and if you can start asking those questions and talking about it and you're having trouble taking it, then maybe they can help you figure out why, you know, you're having trouble taking it. Why aren't you taking them regularly? Maybe it's something we can fix or find a different medicine for you that'll be easier for you to take, that you could tolerate better. So I would really stress, you know, that you expand the conversation so it does include the family, that you don't sit there passively when you're with your doctor, nurse, anybody, but you ask questions, how it affects you, what do you need to do? Not just what does the doctor want to tell you to do, but what are you going to do and what information do you need to make it work for you? And most importantly on here is you gotta ask, what do I do if a seizure occurs? Don't wait till it happens and then feel everybody's frozen and doesn't know what to do. But learn seizure first aid from the beginning. Find out when you should go to the emergency room, when you shouldn't. If a seizure lasts a certain period of time, is there a medicine that you can give right then to help break it?
Mm-hmm.
Versus do you just let it go? And when do you have to take it on an emergency room? Because this gets into all these real complicated issues. And the more you learn and the things you find about what you can do, then the better off you are in being able to manage it. And it's not feeling as overwhelming, whether it's for the individual or for the other family members involved.
That's good stuff.
There's a couple of issues that play into that a little differently than you might think. A lot of people with epilepsy have anxiety, both because it puts you in a situation that's going to make you anxious and nervous, but also because, for reasons we don't exactly know, the same kinds of things that tend to give you seizures also tend to affect the brain to make you anxious. So there's an underlying biological predisposition to anxiety or depression. You're already feeling anxious and depressed, then it makes it harder to ask questions of your healthcare provider. And then also, for certain kinds of epilepsy, it tends to affect memory. So if you're unfortunate enough to be anxious and depressed and have a poor memory, then even if you do have these conversations with the doctor, you might not remember them. So I think it's really important that someone else accompany them to the doctor, but also that they write things down, that they keep asking. So you got to just keep asking. There's sort of, this is a case where there really is no such thing as a dumb question, because people have anxieties that are entirely unfounded sometimes. Or sometimes they're worried about something that we can make better. So it's really important to ask. Ask, ask, ask.
So that I would just jump in on that one, Cynthia, to say, you know, if you've got a family member or friend who is having trouble managing their epilepsy, taking their medications or following whatever the recommendations are, you know, not coping with it well, then maybe there's a bigger problem. Maybe it's not just the seizures, that there is something more. Like Dr. Fountain said, maybe there's some anxiety, some depression, some other things that, you know, if you just leave it alone, it's going to keep getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to treat that problem in addition to the seizures. So, I mean, a person with seizures is just like a person with something else. Other things can happen.
Right.
And, in fact, you're at greater risk of some of these, you know, mood problems. So all the more reason to kind of seek that help.
Well, you know what? I want to let you guys know that we are well past the hour. It happens every single time when I have a show. We think that the hour is going to be enough, and we always, always, always go over the hour. We are over the hour, and there's still so many things for us to talk about. But I'm going to stop you guys right where you are. I would love to kind of reiterate some of the things that you said, like, you know, the questions that you should ask. You should find out what your triggers are. You should understand to have, I think you were talking about knowing a lawyer, knowing the foundations, just in case there are instances of discrimination. Dr. Nathan talked about understanding your condition in school, work, and public life. And most of all, to take your medication, please disclose any condition that you have, not just epilepsy, but if you're getting married, please disclose any condition you might have to your intended so that it's not such a shock to them afterwards. It's very sad to not tell anyone. But most of all, to really, truly, you know, live your life to the fullest, that this should not stop you from living your life to the fullest, because it is something that can absolutely be managed. Anything that you guys want to kind of close out with?
Well, I would want to say thank you very much for having us on here. I think you summed up a number of important points. And, yeah, it's people should not be afraid. Most, you know, take control, take charge, and say, you know, what is it I have? And if I'm still having problems, I need to get some other help. And if I'm not at the right doctor, let me find a specialist in the area. And kind of don't give up till you get the help that you need.
Yes, Dr. Nathan.
I would just say that disclosing things almost always turns out better than you think. I take care of about 3,000 people with epilepsy I have. I keep a database of such things. I have a big, big experience now. While I'm sure this happens more often than I know, I'm only aware in all those times of just a very few, two actually, a case in which someone disclosed having epilepsy turned out to be a problem. And I'm aware of hundreds, if not thousands of times when it was disclosed and it turned out to be a great relief to the person who was disclosing their medical problem, but also the people around, because they know something's kind of up.
Mm-hmm.
By being open and talking about it, it almost always turns out better. And if it doesn't, then at least you can meet it head on. So I'd say those are wise words you said.
Wonderful, wonderful. Again, I just want to thank you both for coming on. I'm so truly grateful that we were able to have this discussion. I want to invite you back on at any time. You know, if there's something new that you want to let us know about, please don't hesitate to let me know. I love having open conversations. I love starting a conversation about things that affect families and affect people. Should we tell them where we can find either one of you?
Sure. Go ahead.
Probably the Epilepsy Foundation is the best place to find things you're after. And you can just Google Epilepsy Foundation, and you'll find the main website, or epilepsy.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at the University of Virginia, and we actually have our own webpage about epilepsy called uvaepilepsy.com. And we have lots of brochures there about the things we've talked about, as well as I think probably has my contact information. So uvaepilepsy.com, all one word.
And I'm at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. But people can also find me on epilepsy.com under the username EpiHelp. And I help answer questions on epilepsy.com, or even can send me a message to the Epilepsy Foundation or Epilepsy Therapy Project on their Facebook. So be more than glad to help people guide them in a direction if they have questions or where to find information.
Wonderful, wonderful. I cannot wait to speak to the both of you again at some point. And I just want to send out a big, big thank you to all the callers that requested this topic, especially, you know, if it's going to help your family. I really wanted it to be something that was informative to help families understand this condition more. To everyone else, as always, you know, we are Tribal Wisdom and Bridal Tribe. We're a company about love, beauty, wedding, and marriage fun. And, of course, it is Health Literacy Month, so it's all about family. Tribal Wisdom is about all things love, wedding, marriage, and families. And since health is so important to us, please stay tuned for next week's show, where we will, we're having a wonderful guest on from, I believe, hold on, she's a wonderful magazine editor that really caters to women over 50, Miss Linda Jackson Corcoran, founder and publisher of Black Women 50 Plus magazine, will be on, and she will be talking about demystifying health issues to inspire rewarding lifestyles. We cannot wait to have her on. We are so thrilled to have her on as well. Again, I want to thank Dr. Nathan. I want to thank Patty for coming on. Everyone, if you missed the show, please, it'll be in the archives. You can listen to this wonderful information again. We will be making up some tribal wisdoms as well for you to read about. And visit the Epilepsy Foundation Facebook page for more information. We love you as always. We are devoted to love. Have a good night.